Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm David Ignatius, a columnist for the Post. We're honored to be joined today by Michael McFaul, who was U.S. ambassador to Moscow and is one of the United States' most thoughtful observers of Russia. Ambassador McFaul, welcome to Washington Post Live.
Thanks for having me, David.
So I want to begin by asking you about your friend, Alexei Navalny. If you could give our viewers a sense, personal sense, of what he was like, of what he believed the future held for Russia, and also if you could just tell us what your own reactions were in the moments after you heard of his death on that terrible Friday in Munich.
So, David, I saw you maybe just 30 minutes after I heard about his assassination, his murder. The night before in Munich, I met with his wife, Yulia, and another one of their colleagues, Leonid Volkov. We had planned to meet that day on Friday to talk about all kinds of things, but mundane things like Dasha, her daughter's graduation party here at Stanford. And that morning she called me and told me the news. It was breaking, but first and foremost, she wanted to, my wife, who knows her daughter well, to find her daughter to make sure she was okay here at Stanford. And I, when I saw you, I was in shock. I want to tell you honestly, I did not believe that they would do this. I thought that just letting him rot in prison for years and years would be sufficient for Mr. Putin. It shows even for me, somebody that's followed Putin's career for 24 years. I wrote my first op-ed in the Washington Post in March of 2020, in fact, about Putin warning about his autocratic ways. Even for me, it was a shock that they decided to kill him. And now I want to be clear, I don't have the evidence, nor does the family, about exactly how he died. But make no mistake, they tried to kill him once. He left. He got better. He went back. They arrested him and they slowly tortured and killed him in just these horrific conditions that he was living in the last days of his life. Yulia explained them, described to me in vivid detail in Munich the way he was living the last days of his life. But to your first question, I would just say a few things. You just described it accurately in the setup piece. He was the most important, most consequential political figure in Russia. And I didn't use the word opposition figure. I said political figure after Vladimir Putin. He was extremely popular when he was allowed to put his toe into electoral politics in 2013, when I was living in Moscow working as ambassador with no access to television, no money whatsoever. He won a third of the vote in Moscow and became so popular because of his anti-corruption themes. And that was principally why he was popular, because he was fighting corruption, that they just decided he was too dangerous to ever have on the ballot again. Second, he was a very principled, smart, engaging person. He made, in my view, some mistakes in the past, things he had said, but he had the courage to acknowledge them. We had one afternoon here at Stanford in my office one day when we debated these many things. And I could hear in his voice that he was rethinking some of the assumptions he had. But in turn, he was asking me to rethink some of my assumptions. And in particular, in the 90s, when the West supported what are now known as neoliberal ideas, he was much more of a social democrat. And he thinks we made mistakes back then. And then finally, just as a person, I would say two things. Just an incredibly funny guy all the time. In the face of danger, one of the letters I got from him in jail, I'm just paraphrasing, but it was, Mike, you know, here I am in jail. I'm one of only two people on the planet that read your tweets printed out. He was referring to himself and Vladimir Putin, but he obviously was following events. He was engaged to the very you know, last day of his life.
Mike, I remember seeing you in the minutes after you'd heard the news and right before you went on air to talk about it. And I remember hearing you almost shouting. I thought you were just so angry, so shaken by what had happened. I want to ask you to take us a little deeper into the conversations you had with Navalny and to the interesting question you just raised. What might we, the United States, or he, Alexei Navalny, have done differently that might have helped him move from that level of support in 2013 to greater support as opposed to the tragic end that we've watched?
Well, as I just alluded to, the first thing that I think Alexei would want us to know was that we were too complacent in the 1990s. You know, this was the end of history. As Frank Fukuyama, my colleague, wrote here, we thought the whole world wanted to be capitalist and democratic. And we just thought it was going to be inevitable that the forces of history were moving in this direction. And that was a moment when we could have done more to help consolidate democracy in Russia, and primarily through more social democratic supports. They endured an economic depression three times as large as the American Depression in the 1930s. And it was in that moment that they were supposed to adopt democratic institutions. And his argument back then would have been, had you provided more of a social safety net and leaned into it then, you might have helped democracy take root. So that was his first main critique. Second, he was very troubled by the fact that we did not take the corruption of Putin's regime more seriously. He knew that we knew what was going on. I mean, he uncovered some incredible stories, and his foundation continues to do so, by the way. And he was always wondering why we knew all this, and yet we chose to say nothing and do nothing about it. I think he would have challenged us to say more about that and do more about that, and to stop corruption, to stop the billions of dollars that Putin has stolen from his country, Russia, and allowed for his crony capitalist friends, oligarchs, to invest in London and Dubai and the United States of America. And then third, I think he would have said that we had underestimated Putin's long-term challenge to the Western world, to liberal democracy. And on this, I want to tell you honestly, I think he was ahead of his time, most certainly than I was, believing that if we did not stop him early, his belligerent activities towards the West, and obviously towards the countries, most dramatically, of course, this horrific, barbaric war in Ukraine, would continue to expand until we took measures to stop that. And the idea that we could negotiate with Putin some kind of resolution to this, believing that it was just a matter of diplomacy would stop him, Alexei thought that was naive.
So those are fascinating recollections and observations. I want to turn, Mike, to the question of the movement that Navalny created and what happens now. The crowds that gathered, in, to me, surprising numbers at his funeral, are said to have chanted, "Do not be afraid," which is what Navalny often said himself. You said in a post on X that the people who attended that funeral or were outside showed incredible bravery. What should they do now? What do the people who believe in Navalny's ideals need to do to sustain this movement against what obviously will be overwhelming repression?
That's a hard question, David, and I don't want to pretend I have a silver bullet answer. I do know, I think it's important, in addition to studying Russia, I teach courses here at Stanford on democratization, revolution, political change. And I would just remind everybody watching that we are oftentimes surprised with democratic breakthroughs because we can't fully understand the preferences of societies that live in totalitarian dictatorships like Putin's Russia. There's some fantastic literature about 1989 in Eastern Europe, where just weeks before the wall came down, we thought that everything was stable there. And that's because people have an incentive to hide their preferences, right? If somebody calls you in Russia today, and you're sitting out in Vladivostok, and Volodya from Moscow says, "Hey, I'm calling to ask you what you think of Putin." There's only one rational answer to that, and so I think that's important for us to understand that just because we can't see resistance in the minds of people doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. I think that the moment right now is for the opposition to consolidate. And I think tragically, but necessarily, Alexei's wife, Yulia Navalnaya, has made the decision that she is going to lead the organization. She never wanted to do this. I've known Yulia for a long time and saw her here in California last week. It was never her intention to do this. But at this moment, she's decided to do it. And I think they have to prove to Russians inside Russia, as well as to the rest of the world, by the way, that this is not the end of the Navalny movement. This is not the end of the democratic movement in Russia. We don't know how long it'll take. I've studied some that have taken decades, right? South Africa, the ANC had to fight for decades before their moment, and their leader spent 27 years in jail before he was allowed out of jail for that democratic breakthrough moment. But I think they have the determination. I think they are good at what they do in terms of their messaging. We've seen it over the last 10 days. And so consolidating that first to give hope to those inside Russia that they'll be there for as long as it takes. And there is a vision for another Russia. I think sometimes Russians, and I think a lot of people in the West, believe that there can never be change in Russia, that there's some kind of genetic code for autocracy. And I think their mission right now is to prove that that is not true. Alexei was just as Russian as Vladimir Putin. I would say he was much more patriotic than Vladimir Putin. And now they need to show that they are still in the fight and that they're fighting for another Russia for however long it may take.
Tell us a bit more about your conversations since Alexei's death with Yulia. You mentioned you were just with her in Stanford, for example. What do you think about the question of whether she should go back? It sounds like a suicide mission, but it's what her husband did.
I don't think she should go back. I don't think she's contemplating that now. There was discussion about whether she should go back or her daughter should go back for the funeral. I think they made the right choice not to go back. And that's just because we have to understand how erratic, how evil Mr. Putin is. And nobody should ever believe that any agreement that you might have with that regime would be honored. Listening to the heroic efforts that Alexei's mother made to negotiate with that regime to finally get his body. Remember, they were saying, "We're either going to bury him here up in the North Pole in Siberia, or you have to agree to a secret burial for him." And she defied that, and she amazingly did what she did. And you've seen exactly what the Kremlin was fearing it happened. But throughout that whole time, there was worry that they would not honor what they were agreeing to. So I think it would not be prudent for Yulia to go back. I think the movement needs her to be alive and active, secure in the West. And by the way, she needs to be worried about her security. Mr. Putin's regime has reached into Germany, Spain, the UK. There's been reports even here in the United States that he is willing to use force and to kill people abroad. And so I hope that Yulia and her movement are taking greater security precautions in the wake of Alexei's death.
Let me ask you one more question about Navalny, and then I want to turn to Ukraine. You have been critical of President Biden, saying that it took too long to impose sanctions about Navalny's arrest. What do you think we should be doing now? Specifically, how can we make whatever sanctions we have greater bite on Putin's regime?
Well, the most important thing we can do to punish Putin is to pass the aid bill that's stuck in the House of Representatives. We'll get to maybe more of those details in a minute, but that's the way you help to defeat Putin domestically, is to defeat him in Ukraine. Alexei Navalny understood this. Yuli understands it, that defeat in Ukraine will help to unravel his grip on power at home. It doesn't mean there'll be a revolution or a coup. I don't think anybody's thinking about that. But defeating him in Ukraine is the best way to help the democratic opposition forces inside Russia. Second, yes, sanctions need to be strengthened and they need to be greater. I applaud what President Biden and the sanctions team have done, the coalition of four dozen countries. It's extraordinary. It's historic. When I sit down to write my book about that someday in the future, I'll give them a lot of credit. But right now, there's more to be done. I think of sanctions like parking tickets. Here at Stanford, if you get a parking ticket on day one and you don't move your car, you get another parking ticket the next day and a third one on the third day. Every day that Putin's army is parked in Ukraine, there should be new sanctions. And when people say there aren't things to do, I run a group on sanctions, a working group on it. We have 300 ideas that we've proposed that can be done. And start, by the way, with the most obvious one, is to take those frozen Russian assets that we have billions of, Europeans have even greater of, and transfer them to Ukraine. That's right before us. There's legislation. It's passed out of both houses in the U.S. Congress, by the way, sponsored by Republicans, Senator Risch on the Senate side, Representative Mike McCaul, not Mike McFaul, Mike McCaul on the House side. I just think that is a no-brainer. And by the way, another no-brainer, combine that with the aid package. I think Speaker Johnson has a tremendous opportunity to put those two bills together and to provide more assistance to Ukraine, not only from the American people, but from Vladimir Putin. Take those assets, give them to Ukraine now.
Let me ask you, have you spoken to Speaker Johnson and other key Republican members of the House who are currently standing in the way of this? And as a related question, I wonder, Mike, if you think that right now, with this aid still not on the way, Russia has the momentum in Ukraine?
Well, so to your first question, I haven't spoken personally to Speaker Johnson. I've spoken to people around him and other members of Congress. And my main message, whenever I get the chance, is, you know, I'm not an expert on American electoral politics, but I have a lot of friends who are, and he's probably has just a few months left as Speaker. And maybe only has a few days left if he puts this bill on the floor, right? That's the threat he faces, that there'll be a movement within his party to push him out like they did to Speaker McCarthy. But if you only have a few more months left, Speaker Johnson, use it to do the right thing. And for goodness sakes, don't be known as the American that blocked aid to Ukraine and allowed Putin to destroy Ukraine. I don't understand how that can be in the Republican Party's electoral interest. If they continue to block this aid, yes, momentum is on Putin's side. I spoke to many Ukrainian officials in Munich, as I'm sure you did, and I speak to them every day. These are desperate times. These are very dangerous times. And so just to hold the line requires this new assistance, just to protect their citizens. Requires new interceptors. We just saw this grotesque killing of civilians in Odessa. That's on us. We could have provided protection for those people. And I just don't understand why Speaker Johnson doesn't get that. Because if he continues to block this aid, he will be recorded as the guy that goes down in history that helped Putin win. And I don't understand how that can be in Mr. Trump's reelection interest. Yes, I get it. His MAGA base wants that. But how is he going to get anybody else to vote for him? And, you know, I worked on one campaign in 2008 rather intimately. I worked with Ukrainian Americans in Pennsylvania and Polish Americans in Michigan and Lithuanian Americans in places like Wisconsin. There is no way that this is in their electoral interest to be known as the people that handed Ukraine to Russia.
I want to ask you about one other aspect of the risk in this war, and that's the risk that it could lead to some kind of nuclear confrontation. We had an interesting exchange last week where President Macron of France said that if Kyiv was endangered, European countries led by France should consider putting troops in to stop the Russians. The response of Putin was extraordinary. He made the most explicit threat to use nuclear weapons, I believe, that has come so far in the conflict. How do you read these threats from Putin, from former President Medvedev, others, that Russia might choose to use nuclear weapons? How should we deal with that threat? And do you worry that we're overreacting to it?
It's a serious threat. I think in the fall of 2022, it peaked. From my conversations with the Biden administration officials when Putin was losing, and he rolled it out again. I don't know what their probability assessment was over his recent comments, but most certainly he uses it as a trump card to deter us in the West. And, you know, if I were working at the White House again, if I, you know, was Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, that's a serious threat that has to be taken very seriously in terms of calculating what our response should be. My sense today is that they're a lot less concerned about him using a nuclear weapon, although I don't know what their recent calculations were with regard to his comments about in response to President Macron. But I do know that he has successfully deterred us from providing weapons to the Ukrainians that they feel they need to effectively stop Putin's army in Ukraine. I'm not a general, I can't assess that, but that is their assessment. And so at this point, you know, if the aid bill comes through, just again, on the strategy and the politics, the American people are gonna wanna see some benefit from providing $50 billion in new aid. And I think therefore it is imperative for the Biden administration to do more, especially with the long-range missiles, to give Ukraine the ability they need, especially to go on the offensive in Crimea. I think that's where Putin is most vulnerable. And as the Ukrainians always say to me, including the most senior Ukrainians that I've talked to about this issue, remember, the nuclear threat is about their country, not about our country. And they find it a bit disingenuous of us that their assessment of the threat to their country, that we should leave it to them to make those assessments and not let us judge for them what's in their national interest.
We have just a minute or so left, and I want to ask you to quickly think with us about the future of Russia. There's a presidential election later this month. I want to say a mock presidential election in Russia. But I'm curious, Mike, how you see the future, assuming now that Putin doesn't take Kyiv, that for whatever combination of reasons, he's not triumphant in Ukraine. Do you see Russia in a period of long-term decline? What's the Russia that you would expect to see 10 years from now, assuming, as I say, that they're not successful in Ukraine?
So I'd say two things. So one, I already think Russia's in long-term decline right now. We get fooled when we look at GDP numbers because of big spending. But Russia today, had they gone in a more democratic, market-friendly way in 2000, could be one of the richest countries in the world, could most certainly be the most powerful democratic country in the world had Putin not veered in this opposite way. Putin is killing innovation inside Russia. He's chasing away the best and the brightest. I just spoke to, I should be careful about reporting on things that are not public, but you wouldn't be surprised that some of the most talented people in Russia that created some of the best companies in Russia are now living in the United States and Israel because there's no room for them in Putin's Russia. He's killed investment. ExxonMobil, that was a $500 billion deal that was going to bring all kinds of technology to Russia. It's dead and it's never coming back. So, and a million people have left Russia. The best and the brightest have left. They live here in Palo Alto with me. That's part of the decline. And I think tragically that'll continue while Putin is in power. And I don't see any scenarios that he'll be overthrown. Tragically, he's constructed a pretty effective dictatorship. However, after Putin, I think all bets are off. I don't see long-term institutions as he's created. I don't see a successor. I don't see a political party. I don't see an ideology besides this personalistic dictatorship that lasts. And I know lots of people, even to this day, I've been on the sanctions list for a decade. I still talk to people in that regime that lament the way it's gone. So I think the day after Putin will be a tumultuous time. I'm not brave enough to try to predict the way it might go, but the idea that it will be a totalitarian dictatorship for decades to come, that to me is the much more unlikely outcome. As you say, 10 years out, 2 years out, yes. 10 years out, no. 20 years out, absolutely not. And the last thing I would say on this, David, if you look at who supports Putin and who does not, the future does not. The younger you are, the more educated you are, the more urban place you live, the richer you are, the less likely you are to support Putin. And that's the future of Russia. And they are not with Putin and Putinism.
So on that hopeful note, and I will say that is a 10, 20 year out future is one that Russian people, I think, would agree is a hopeful one. We'll have to end it. Ambassador McFaul, thank you so much for joining us. A really extraordinary conversation. Come back and see us again.
Thanks for having me, David.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.